This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Hey, have you had a chance to like our Facebook page? Well, if you haven't, surf on over to Facebook.com and like us today. That is at The Magic Word Podcast. Also, if you don't follow us yet on Twitter, today's a good day to sign up for that also. You can follow me on Twitter at Magic Word Pod. And if you want to follow on Instagram and see some of the pictures from Thursday night's Magic and Martini night, you can just follow me at Scott Wells Magic. That'll be great. And then finally, to subscribe to The Magic Word, you need to go to themagicwordpodcast.com and just go to the tab that says subscribe, and you should be able then to make sure you don't miss another episode of The Magic Word Podcast. And speaking of which, today we have just a fantastic guest, and I am honored to have Bob Fitch as my guest because he is someone who is, as I say early on in the podcast, is the gold standard. He's the one to whom others are compared. He's a fellow that's been around for a long time. He's won lots of major awards, things on Broadway as well as within the magic community. On Broadway, in fact, he has won the Burris Mantle Award, which was on Broadway for the best featured actor in a musical, which was Annie, where he performed some years ago. And he's had other types of awards that he has won on Broadway as well, and he has had a lot of accomplishments, like he was one of the first ever to teach modern jazz in San Francisco. And he also even taught dance to Gene Kelly's brother and to Fred and Nico Charisse, who is Sid Charisse's husband. And he also had understudied under Ray Bolger and Donald O'Connor. Those are some names in the past. I know some of the younger guys may have to do a little Google to figure out who those guys are. And aside from that, of course, that he has won some other major awards within the Magic organization. The Parent Assembly number one of the SAM had him as the Magician of the Year a few years back, and the Magic Castle has awarded him with a Lifetime Achievement Award. Bob has been conducting workshops on choreography and magic for a number of years and has inspired and taught so many people. In fact, that some of the quotes that I have heard said about him, one comes from Eugene Berger, who says that Bob Fitch is a national treasure. And then actor and comedian Steve Martin had said, "Follow in Bob's footsteps." I did. And so I think that if you haven't had a chance to catch Bob at one of his workshops, or if you haven't seen him at a magic convention where he's been a featured lecturer, you get an opportunity here to hear some of the things that he covers in his short one-hour lecture when he is at magic conventions. He was recently at the Texas Association of Magicians convention, and I didn't have a chance to catch up with him during the convention, but I gave him a call on Skype a little bit later and recorded this conversation that you're going to get to hear today. Much of what he covers are some things that he had spoken about during that lecture, so if you happen to hear the lecture, you get to enjoy it again, and for those who haven't, you're going to learn some really good stuff. I know that I certainly did. So, please welcome my guest for today, Mr. Bob Fitch, here on the Magic Word Podcast. Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and it gives me great pleasure today to welcome as my guest, Mr. Bob Fitch. Hello, Bob.
Hello. Hello, Scott. Thank you for having me.
Hey, it's always good to be had. And so, and you, sir, you, sir, are a wonderful asset. I was just thinking this morning before this conversation about how people will say certain things, like they will compare something to a standard. For an example, well, that's kind of like Van Gogh, or you know, that's like Vermeer, or that's kind of, I can see Andy Warhol. In other words, you're comparing somebody's art to somebody else, and right. I find that a lot of times people will say, well, we're going to be doing a workshop, like a Bob Fitch workshop type of a thing, you know.
Yeah.
So you're the one that it's the gold standard. You're the one that everybody is compared to. And for obvious reasons, the kinds of things that you have done to help people's acts by polishing. And I was just describing this to somebody last night about the kind of things that you do that by having that extra set of eyes and with the experience that you have when someone is, myopic and can't see that in themselves necessarily, that you can kind of sit back and say, well, you know, instead of walking across the stage, why don't you just move the table a little bit closer? Something that's just minor like that, and it's like, boom, wow, why didn't I think of that? That makes so much sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's always one thing, I think, that turns people around. I've kind of come to that conclusion this year after all the years of doing things where I tried in workshops to give people as many tools as possible, visual tools, blocking tools, character tools, whatever, ideas of how to make it better, how to speak better. And I this year I realized it's really not about how much you give them, but about touching on one thing that possibly they either really want or really need. And if you hit upon that, it takes them someplace. They perk up, they turn around, they see things they never saw before, and then it sort of motivates them to keep going and keep learning and being more aware. And I don't have to do so much. It's really finding that one little clue that will help people.
I think that's a very important key that you touched on there, Bob, because whenever that I have given private lessons to magicians online. I give Skype lessons and things like this, or people come to my home and I give lessons.
I'll buy one.
That if I teach more than three things in an hour, they're going to forget everything because it's too much information. They're trying to assess and learn something new. If it's one thing, certainly that you can spend a lot of time on that. It's like, oh, I got that. But continuing to do that over and over, and then maybe moving on to the other one, like another 20 minutes later, I think that, again, it's maybe the miracle of the number three or something. But it seems to me that that's about the amount of information that a person can assess in an amount of time. Now, I don't know if that means within 2 hours that they could assess six things or not, or maybe it's just, three things a day or whatever.
Up to them. Yeah. It's really up to them.
Well, that's a good point, too. Do you find that sometimes when you're working in a workshop or you've got a student that there are several things you're saying, man, we just need to kind of tear this apart and start from ground level, or do you just really polish it?
Depends on what they need. Some people kind of know what they need. I want to speak better. I want to communicate better. My character isn't developed. I need blocking. I mean, there's 10,000 things they could possibly say. And on the other hand, many people don't know what they want. They just know that, like Steve Bargatze said to me at one time, he said, I've reached a ceiling and I don't know what to do or where to go or how to get past that. I want my ceiling to be my floor. Great metaphor.
Yeah.
So they didn't know what it was. Sometimes it's their own perception of themselves or a lack of it. Sometimes people don't really know who they are or just what their skills really are. Maybe they're untried, untested aspects of themselves that they don't know is really powerful for them and can make them better. And it's helping them touch upon that. Sometimes people have definitions of themselves that get in the way of them being able to fully express themselves. Bill Malone, he wrote on an application to me, and I was the only one that knew it. And he tells this on himself, so it's okay to go with this, He said, I don't know if I'm funny. And every time I try, I don't get laughs. Every time I don't try, I get laughs. I don't understand it. So my thought when I read that was, oh, gosh, how do I prove to him he is funny? Because we're all laughing. We would say, what? He's hysterical.
Right.
But if you told him that, he would say, thank you very much. Like many comics, they never think they're funny, so they're really trying harder. So how do I prove to him? My problem, I felt, was how do I prove to him he's funny? Because you can't tell him that. So
right.
Somehow he has to experience the difference so that he can have that aha moment when the light bulb goes on and he said, oh, I am funny.
So how did you go about doing that? I mean, what did you say to him?
Well, it was an actor's exercise that I used on him. It was kind of an accident and an instinctive thing. He was doing, his card trick, Bill Malone, the card story.
Sam the Bellhop.
And I said, Bill, let's try something. This is how many actors learn their lines, so that they're not just mechanical and robotic saying their lines. They try to get in touch with how they feel in the moment. So they will break up their lines with stating how they feel in the moment and then go on with the lines. For instance, if I were to say, we're going to have breakfast this morning, and then after that we're going to take we're going to hear a lecture, and after the lecture we're going to see a show. Okay, three things: breakfast, lecture, show.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He said, okay, this morning we're going to have breakfast, and why am I worried about this? Why are my hands shaking? This is really ridiculous. Okay, I'll shake them out. Okay. Let's get on with it, Bob. And then after that, we're going to hear a lecture. Why is that guy looking at me like that? Didn't he hear me? Am I speaking clearly?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's okay. He's just rubbing his eye. All right, okay. Okay, then after that, we're going to have a show. Okay, that's the exercise. I say my lines, but I get in touch with how I feel in the moment, and I say it out loud. And that way I keep in touch with myself. I don't get lost in being a robot, right? So that becomes expressive when you say the lines. Anyway, so he did. He said something that really wasn't funny, and somebody laughed. So he spoke up and he said, hey, if you do that again, I'm going to leave. Well, that's funny.
Yeah.
The guy laughed again,
uh-huh.
And Bill went on with the effect, with the trick, the story. I said, Bill, stop. So what? I said, stand up and go to the back of the room. And he stared at me. I said, Bill, didn't you hear me? Stand up and go to the back of the room. Bill, don't try to figure it out. Just do it.
Yeah.
Get up and go to the back of the room. I swear to God, I had to do it about 30 times. Then later that evening, Bob Sheets said to me, he said, you know, he didn't understand why you did that. And I went, oh, God, Bob, thank you so much. Oh, you just saved me. Okay, so the next morning when we got together, I said, Bill, do you know why I did that? He said, no, I don't. I said, oh, okay, I was simply trying to get you in touch with the exercise. Now, I know you weren't used to doing it. It was the first time. But you said to the guy, if you do that again, I'm going to leave. He did it again, and you went on with the trick. I wanted you to do what you said, which was to get up and leave, go to the back of the room.
Uh-huh.
I said, now, did you notice what happened when you finally got up and went to the back of the room? You didn't say one word, Bill. You looked at him. He laughed. You got up and started to turn around, and then you looked back at him. And everybody laughed.
Mm-hmm.
You went to the back of the room to the door as if you were going out. You looked around again. You got another laugh. I said, come and sit down now. He came and sit down, and you looked at us with a scowl on your face. You got a fourth laugh. Bill, do you realize you didn't say one word? You got four laughs. Now, if that doesn't prove to you that you're funny, I don't know what will. Okay, now the next session, which you have tomorrow, I want you to come in, and I don't want to see a trick. I don't want to see any tricks. I just want you to be Don Rickles and walk among the guys here and insult us.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever comes to your mind, anything, there's no right or wrong, just whatever comes out. Well, he came in the next day, and he blew us away. He was saying, oh, what are you looking at? What do you think you're looking at? Got your nose all up and whatever. I don't know. I'm not funny. He was funny.
Yeah.
His comments were funny. We laughed. And after that was over, I said, see, you improvised. You did what you felt. You were in touch with how you felt, and that's what you said. So you improvised a funny dialogue. Very funny. We were on the floor.
Yeah.
I said, now, that proves to you you're funny. Well, he wrote me a month later, and he said, I can't believe it. You know, I was trying to work in the past on one effect and write a story, write jokes, whatever. And it took me a month to finally finish it. He said, now I'm working on 30 things and I'm finishing all of them. So in other words, in his mind, he didn't think he was funny. He thought it was all about the jokes. He didn't know that he was funny. His reactions, his responses to people, his in the moment ad libs, you know, while he's doing the trick, were hilarious.
Right.
And it wasn't the jokes. I mean, the jokes were funny because he was saying them, but that's what he thought it was the joke. No, it was him. So he learned about him, and he finally got confidence and threw away his wrong definition about himself. And after that, he did a series of tapes called Bill Malone on the Loose. That was after the workshop.
Oh.
And he was so funny on that, on those tapes.
I've got those DVDs. Yeah, that is very funny. It's a good set.
That happened right after he did the workshop. And the difference was amazing. So he learned about himself. He found out who he was, you know, and what his skills were.
If he delivers those lines the way he does with his character, with his facial expressions, it is completely different from anybody else. In other words, like when you were trying to repeat the humor that he was doing, you're saying, well, I'm not saying it the same way that he was, but we were all just on the floor laughing. And so if you or I were to try to emulate that style, I don't think it would work for us as well, because
that's right.
Him. And the same thing with Bob Sheets. I think Bob Sheets is funny as well, but also he's got that diastema, you know, gap between his teeth, and kind of has a goofy look when he smiles sometimes.
He's also dyslexic.
And oh, is that right?
He came to my first workshop, and he basically came to most of the workshops. Can I tell you a Bob Sheets story?
Please do, yes.
Bob Sheets is just lovely, a lovely guy. He came to the first workshop. We were dying. He was just plain funny. And I asked him about, I said, well, Bob, I don't know what to do for you. Why are you here at the workshop? He said, I don't know. I said, oh, he said, I just know I can be better. I don't know how. I said, what's that first joke you told when you pulled the rope out of your shirt at your belly button? He said, well, I'm first born. Right. I said, well, okay, that's funny. He said, yeah, no, but I got to change it. It doesn't work as well as I thought. I said, huh. Okay, what about this? And I asked him, I remember asking him about five questions which had to do with what he was doing in the moment with the rope. You know, and they were all sort of metaphorical, and they were all funny. And I said, what was that joke when you did this? What was that joke when you did that? And he told me, and I said, well, that's funny. He said, yeah, but I got to change it. Five times he said, yeah, but I got to change it. And I said, ah, now I know how I can help you. You know, Bob, it doesn't matter what new jokes you put in there. None of them are going to work. What? What? I said, you don't want them to work. What? I said, wait. Three ways you don't want them to work. First of all, you're looking down at the floor when you tell your joke, when you tell your punchline. There's nobody down there. You got to look at us and deliver the message. Number two, the end of your sentence goes down. The end of your sentence goes down. What? The end of your sentence should go up. The end of your sentence goes down. Not down. Down. I want to hear the last word. It's the object of the sentence. It's the punchline. If I don't hear it, how can I laugh? And the third thing you do is you walk on it. Your words go down, you look down, and you walk away. Okay? Now, I'm going to nail your shoes to the floor. Bang, bang, bang. They're nailed to the floor. You cannot move. I want to hear the words of your punchline. I want them to go up at the end. I want you to look us in the face and sell a joke. And the fourth thing, really, is you do a run-on sentence. You don't give us a chance to contemplate what you've just said, to process it. Two Irishmen walked out of a bar. You get on. What? You got to leave a space between your setup. Two Irishmen walked out of a bar and your punchline. So you can do that by either taking a breath between the two sections or shrugging your shoulders while you're looking at us, please. So I'm going to shrug my shoulders in between. Two Irishmen walked out of a bar. It could happen.
Yeah, that's funny.
You know, well, it's not great funny, but it's at least you'll get a chuckle out of it.
Serves the point. I understand exactly what you're saying.
So I took a breath there, shrugged my shoulders because you can't see me, and I looked at you, and I kept the last word up.
Yeah.
It could happen. Two Irishmen walked out of a bar. It could happen. No, it could happen. I can't do it. Two Irishmen walked out of a bar. Stop. It could happen. It could happen.
It could happen, yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. And I said, so the problem here is that you don't think you're funny like Malone. You think it's the jokes that are funny. But you are funny, and you are hiding behind your joke by looking down. You kind of feel like you're not worthy of delivering the joke. That's because of your dyslexia. In fact, why do you do magic, Bob? Well, he never answered me. He came back the next year. I asked him the same question. Why do you do magic? Well, yeah, I like magic. You know, I like to make them laugh. Yeah, okay, that's fine. That's not good enough. Then he asked me to come out to Magicopolis in Santa Monica for a week to work with him on his show. And we stopped in the middle of the street with the light changing from green to red. And I said, right now you're going to tell me why you do magic, or else you're going to have to pay for my hotel until you do. I'm staying here. He said, well, would it be something like this? Most magicians like to fool you. I don't like to fool you. I like to fool with you. I said, that's it. That's it. You like to fool people. You like to scam them. You like to, pardon my French, screw with them.
Yeah, mess around with them. Yeah.
Mess around with their heads.
Yeah.
I said, and your dyslexia is the perfect way to do that. You start off and you're going the wrong direction, and you got this kind of stutter, I can't make up my mind what I'm going to say kind of thing, and the people think you're an idiot. And then you hit them over the head with the effect, and they just realize they have been scammed. They have been conned. They have been misled. And you let them down the garden path, and then you whack them. That's who you are. And you can use this very quality that you're going to try to hide. And that's Bob Sheets. I said, now, you have to do that in every trick you do, some kind of messing with their heads. That's your character. That's your method.
Right.
That's your style. And nobody else can do that because that's who you are. And nobody can copy that.
Well, you know, that kind of reminds me a little, I guess, of David Williamson. There's another brilliant magician and a very smart man and someone who fools the pants off of everybody every time. But he does it in such a disarming way because he has engaged the audience with humor, or what if he has kids up there, the way he moves people around or whatever. I mean, he acts goofy up there, but at the end, it's like, boom, he just hits you with some mystery that's solid. It's like, wow, that was great.
And part of all these guys that makes it work is they involve the audience so much in their process. The audience can't stand back and assess it or analyze it. They get so involved with the human. My My definition of magic, one of my questions on the questionnaire is, what's your definition of magic? I've had some brilliant definitions. Mm-hmm. My personal definition is one that was given to me by my friend Ed Bordeaux, who used to work the workshop with me. It's people see magic when they see a human being doing superhuman feats. The primary word there is human.
Okay.
So if I'm copying somebody else, or if I don't quite know who I am as I make my delivery, as to how I make my delivery, as to how I set up my story, as to how I set up my routine, then they don't see who I am.
Mm-hmm. When you were at the TAOM and lecturing, there was another magician we were talking about, or you had mentioned, that was Steve Bragazzi, and you mentioned him earlier as well. And he is somebody who, you said, wanted his ceiling to be his floor to move on up, and that he found his character. He didn't know who he was either, and you shared a story. Is that something? Can you tell that one as well?
Yes, I can. Sure. Stephen came, and he talks like this. I mean, he doesn't talk like that now. Mm-hmm. But when he came in, I can't think of the character's name. It was a comic on television.
Sylvester the Cat.
in the 50s.
Okay.
He had a lisp like this. He talked like this. And you could hardly understand him. And I want to say Mr. Wimple, but it isn't that. Uh-huh. I can see the guy. But he talked like this. Anyway, he came in. And Ed Bordeaux, my friend, was teaching speech at the time, and he said to everyone on the speech class, he said, we're going to work on the muscles of speech to make it more articulate. So those muscles are the lips, the tongue, and the jaw. Mm-hmm. And since we'd already heard Stephen speak, Ed touched Stephen on his jaw. He said, and Stephen, we're going to really work on your jaw. And Stephen said, don't you touch me. I had it with guys like you. I was 9 years old when a dog bit me on, I'm not going to do his heavy sibilance. Dog bit me on the face when I was 9. I've had 9 plastic surgeries on my face. He bit off, I don't know, 1/3 to 1/2 of my tongue. He said, that's why I have this speech impediment. And he said, those guys, they put me down in the room with stupid kids. They did nothing for me. So you don't touch me. And everybody in the workshop backed up to the wall. And Ed stood there calmly and he said, wow. Oh, Stephen, what a story. My God, what you've been through. He said, okay, look, you've got a defect. We can't heal your defect. But this is a 7-day workshop, and I can promise you that you will have better speech, more clarity in 4 days. In 4 days, that means you'll get better laughs because people will understand you better. Mm-hmm. He said, now look, you paid your money to come here. Why don't you give us a chance? See what we can do for you in 4 days. If we can't do anything in 4 days, I piped up, we'll give you your money back. Now, Ed said, do you want to give us a chance, or do you just want to be a victim all your life? He hit him with that. That's a left hook.
Wow.
Stephen said, oh, okay, okay, okay. And in 4 days, he started talking like this. He was talking like this. Yeah, I heard a lot of syllables, but he was much clearer. And everyone in the workshop said, oh, good Lord, Stephen, how wonderful is this? He called his wife on the phone, and he said, you won't believe what they did for me. Okay, let's skip forward 1 year. I was at the IBM convention in San Diego lecturing, and Stephen was also, but I didn't know that. And I got a call on Saturday morning and it said, Bob, can you come and help me? The other guy that was supposed to lecture with me didn't show up with the kids. Can you help me? And I'm saying, yes. Who is this? And something was familiar.
Yeah.
The tone.
Uh-huh.
And he said, "Oh, for God's sake." That's all I heard. Sake.
And then you knew.
It's Steve Bargatze.
Yeah.
I said, "Okay, I'll be right over." And so we hugged and all that. And I said, "Speak to me." He said, "Oh, for God's sake, what do you want me to say?" I said, "Oh, my God, Stephen, what did you do?" I said, "Your defect is gone."
Mm-hmm.
And he pulled out of his wallet an onion skin paper, typing sheet size. And he said, "Here, here's every exercise we did in speech class at the workshop a year ago. I have done these exercises every day for a year for 15 minutes every morning." And I just about lost it. And I said, "Oh, my." And he said, "And you did it. You did it for me." I said, No. "We didn't do it. You were ready to do it. All we did was open a door, and you jumped through it.
Mm-hmm.
We gave you the exercises. You're the one who got rid of your defect. You've been doing it every day for 15 minutes. Stephen, it's like a miracle. It's like a laying on of hands. My God, it's wonderful." And we both lost it. We both cried and hugged. And after that, Stephen was no longer afraid to tell people about his story, about the dog.
Yeah.
You know, and he's just one of the best motivators ever. I've seen him in a school show. And after he finishes the show, and he says to them, he says, "So, kids, how did you like my show?" And they all applaud, and huge applause. And he said, "Well, I'm the man, right?" And he said, yeah, you're the man." And he hits the kids. They chase him around the auditorium.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's outrageous, and it's wonderful. And at that point, he said, "Yeah, I'm the man. That's what you just said. But you know what this man went through?" And he now tells them the story when he was 9 and what happened and all he went through to be able to speak clearly again and look as good as he does. He said, "So I solved all my problems. I took care of them. Now what are you going to do with yours?" He puts it right to the kids.
Wow.
Silence. Well, those kids, if they're not motivated, I don't know who is. It's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
And he found out who he was, and he uses it. He doesn't hide from it anymore, you know. And in terms, you mentioned his character. I think we got off on that. When he was starting off at our workshop, he did the Caps 11 card trick.
Right.
Or 11 bill trick,
mm-hmm.
You know. And he had two ladies who were shorter than he, because he's a tall guy.
Right.
On either side of him. And he was, you know, $11. Okay, you count them. 10. Give me another one over here.
Mm-hmm.
He takes it back. 10. Give me another one. And everybody's laughing. And I got scared because when he did it, I felt like he was angry.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Stephen, who are you?" "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, what's your character?" I said, "Well, you got a funny hat, funny little tail coat, wild colors. Now you're built like a pear, and you do a funny little shuffle like Chaplin. So what are you?" "So, well, I'm a clown." I said, "What kind of clown? A Joey clown, white-faced clown, a bum clown, a classic clown, a commedia dell'arte clown? What kind of clown are you?" "I don't know." I said, "I know. You're a physical clown. You're funny looking. You walk funny. You know, you're visually funny. Now, you cannot do this $11 bill trick anymore with a woman on either side of you. They've got to be 11 feet away from you. So you have to do your funny shuffle to this lady. Give me 11. Ooh, thank you very much. Now I walk. And I count them, 10. 10! And now all that energy is dissipated in space with his physical movement and his blocking.
That makes all the difference. Wow.
And he becomes a physical clown. And I said, "Now you cannot do any trick anymore without your physicality being involved in it somehow. That's who you are."
Right.
"That's how you look. That's how you act. That's your character. You got to use the character."
Was that his aha moment then?
That's absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely right. And just, it's wonderful. I just get chills. you know, it's the one thing. If you find that one thing, by God, it light bulbs go on and people brighten up and they suddenly get excited about performing again and finding the new you and applying who they are to everything they know. It just permeates their whole soul.
That's true. You know, and you had mentioned something during the lecture, again, at the TAOM here recently that moved and motivated me, and which that I'm still employing, not just in performances, but in daily life. Specifically, the one thing that you talked about earlier about Bob Sheets, and that is finishing your sentences with an up rather than down and not looking down, because that's one way of making sure that they hear the punchline. And so you finish your sentences up like that. So I'm really trying to be conscientious of that. And the other thing that you had mentioned that I incorporate, or I'm trying to, and that is to look at somebody and finish your sentence, particularly when you're in a larger group or on stage or even at a restaurant when I'm performing tables or a cocktail party or whatever, that rather than kind of scanning the group back and forth with finishing the same sentence on whoever randomly happened to hit, actually hold the attention of one person and finish that sentence. And then I'll turn to another person as I'm going into my next sentence. It may still be part of the same thought or the same paragraph in my mind, I guess, but that way that they feel as if that I'm talking to them and not at them. And so that's making a big difference in the way that I am actually, I mean, I've been obviously talking for over 60 years, so now I'm learning something new about how I should have been communicating. And I was a salesman in a former life, and successful at that from the standpoint of being able to talk to people and sell people things. And perhaps I was using that to some degree, but not knowing consciously that's what I was doing. So now I'm trying to be more conscious to make sure that I do that.
Terrific. So, it's exciting, isn't it?
It is, and I thank you very much for that. You know?
You're very welcome. Sometimes a thought can be two or three sentences.
Mm-hmm.
And so finish the thought with that one person. Like you saw J. Scott Barry, he was sitting in the front row when you saw the lecture. And I asked him if he'd get up and talk. And he's a very elegant speaker.
Yes.
Good-looking guy, elegant speaker, uses his words very well. And so what can possibly make him any better? And so he's talking to everybody, maybe about why he likes the convention or why he likes magic, whatever it is. And I was sitting in front, so I was sort of like a conductor. I would sort of point my finger when he finishes what I felt was his thought. I would point my finger to the other side, and he'd look over there and finish the thought. I'm looking over to my right now as if there's somebody over here. It's a teddy bear, I think. And when I finish my thought with him, I see that he's got it. He's bobbing his head.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Now I'm going to take a look over here to my left, and we'll see what we can give over here. Well, he did that and looked front and all that. And I heard murmurs from the audience, wow. And afterwards I talked to him and I said, so how did that feel different? He said, it sure did. He said, I felt like I was really connecting with people instead of talking well, at them. I always thought I was talking to them, but mm-hmm. I realize now the idea in my head was I was speaking to everybody, which is kind of like a lighthouse. You know, the lighthouse,
right, exactly.
The light goes zoom, mm-hmm. and goes around in a circle. Mm-hmm. Zoom, and it's not focusing on anything. It's just lighting up the area, mm-hmm. and scanning,
mm-hmm.
you know. So,
and the audience can detect that also. They don't feel as if that they're engaging with the performer on stage if they are just getting that momentary scan. I mean, they feel
absolutely.
Like, you know, that's what, like in concerts, whenever that someone will point to someone from the stage and someone in that general area say, hey, he's pointing to me, you know, and jumping up
right.
and down or whatever. So it's the same thing. I think that if you can connect with someone rather than just doing that searchlight across their face, that they will, even though you may be looking in a general direction, like to several rows, each of those people in that row think you're there. You're looking at them and connecting
absolutely.
With them.
The finger pointing thing,
yes,
is really good. The psychological effect it has on the audience, I finally figured it out, is that he's really talking to them, and you see people in the audience leaning forward,
mm-hmm.
and the feeling. It's not a logical feeling. It's kind of an intuitive feeling or hope, is that maybe he'll look at me. So they pay more attention to you. And they're really, now they're really listening. They're really connecting. A friend of mine, Margaret Steele, who came to the workshop, was at the castle working. She starts on Monday night. She was in the palace, in the stage portion of the castle. She called me Tuesday morning, and she said, "Oh, my God, oh, my God." And I said, "What?" She said, "They had somebody watching my first show last night, and he came up to me last night, and he said, if you do that show tomorrow night like this, you're not going to work the rest of the week here." And she said, "I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do." And I said, "Well, oh boy, what felt different to you?" And she said, "Well, you know, the spotlight in the palace, it's a low ceiling. So the spotlight is at the back. But on the stage, it's at eye level. It doesn't come down from above you at a 45-degree angle. So if you were to juggle, it would be impossible unless you turn sideways.
It's blinding, yeah.
It's blinding." She said, "So I could not see the audience." She said, "I like to see the audience." I said, "Oh, okay. Okay, then you do this. You go down there this afternoon and you practice this. You practice this. This is an actor's sense memory exercise. You talk about sense memory. This is what it is." "Okay, over on the left, stage left, from your point of view, it's your left side. There's an exit sign over the door to the palace. I want you to look over in that direction and pretend your mother is sitting in the seat right under that. Now, what is she wearing? Create it. Has she got a pearl necklace on? Is it a purple dress? Does it have spots in it? Lines in it? What does she do? Does she hold her hands when she watches you? How does she watch her little girl when she performs? Does she laugh? Is she proud? Create that. Create that. Find that moment that you know how she reacts. Okay? Do that. Pay attention to it. Create it in the moment. Try to see it when you're doing the magic. Okay, let's go to the center. Your boyfriend is back there. Underneath the spotlight. Okay. What's he wearing? What's the color of his tie? What's his coat like? He has to wear, you know, dress code at the castle. Okay. What's he wearing? How does he like his girlfriend performing on stage, getting applause? Is he proud of her? Is he smiling? Is he said, "Oh, she's my girl." What is he doing? What is he doing? You know him. You know how he reacts. You have to create it. Okay, over on the right, there's another little exit sign. Your little dog is there. Is he standing on his hind legs with his legs up in the air, wiggling, with his tongue hanging out because he loves seeing you up there in the light? This all sounds very silly and very trite, but it's a real thing. It's almost like, you know, a living, moving meditation. And that's an actor's trick. And that's how to get out of yourself and get into the moment. I said, "Now create it. Absolutely believe that you see those people and you call me after tonight's performance." She called me. She said, "I can't believe it. I can't believe it." I said, okay. What happened? She said, "The guy came up to me and he said, 'Well, if you'd done that last night, I wouldn't have come up to you.' He said, 'That was a great show.'" She said, "So I'm here for the rest of the week. Thank you." That was it. She couldn't see the audience. That was what threw her.
But she just envisioned what the audience would be like.
That's right.
And who was actually out there.
Specifically. And let me add one thing. Let me think. I worked with Eric DeCamps.
Yeah.
He was working at a jazz club every Saturday night in New York City. And he did beautiful stories and everything, but his was to look at trick was to look at one person and finish the thought. We did that with him, and it made a huge difference. But also, he had a particular skill that I wish I had better, which was he remembers people's names very handy in business.
It is.
And he is a businessman mm-hmm. besides. However, I said, let's use that memory thing. You get somebody up to do a card trick or whatever trick with you. You get their name. So you know where they're sitting, right? Mm-hmm. Now, after you've done two or three, four people, how about this? You ask John, I'm going to turn my back. I want you to show everybody the card you selected and then put it back in the deck so I don't know what it is or where it is, okay? Okay, John, tell me when you're finished. Okay, I'm finished. Okay, John. Mary, did you see the card way over there? Mm-hmm. He looks at Mary, who was up on the stage at one point. He knows where she's sitting. And he looks over on the other side. He said, George, did you see it? Were you able to see the card? Okay, good. He'll hit maybe three people doing that. Hmm. Everybody leans forward because he's remembering names and where they are. And the impulse is that he may call me. Now, it's illogical because he doesn't know their names. But that's the same feeling as sharing one thought with one person at a time. It even enhances that idea because you're actually using people's names.
Right? No
that's
question.
An incredible moment. And it suddenly made him personal and not robotic.
Right. Whenever I am finished with a strolling engagement and I've been performing at someone's home or in a business environment, and as I leave, not only do I, of course, thank my host by name, but often those people who I'm walking through the party again, I say, you know, thanks, Alice or Jane or Joe. Just I thank them as they're going out. And they'll kind of turn their head and say, how does he remember my name? You know, I have a very good short-term memory. I mean, tomorrow I won't remember their names at all, but this is a little tip that I have used. Once I was in an elevator, and a guy had recognized me and said, yeah, you had me up on stage. You remember? Sure. And I'll say, yeah, your name is Steve, right? And he said, no, it's Jim, you know. And I said, oh, well, at least there are some vowels in there. You know, just kind of get a little bit of a laugh. But the important thing is that I try to remember, just say something. Somebody's name, a name. You may be right. It could be his name's. No, it's Steven, not Steve, or whatever. Might be get lucky or something. It's kind of like a playing card. Was this your card? Yes, it was, and I'm done. But the thing is, at least that you're trying to engage with them and to recognize them. But I was going to say, going back some years ago, when I was really starting to do more stage work, and gosh, this was when I used doves and rabbits, livestock, and everything in my earlier years. But I found that I was a little bit nervous when I was going to be performing for a group of disparate people. That is, there needed to be at least one or more people who I knew who were going to be in the audience, because the first few people who were booking, that booked my show, were people that I knew, their companies or whatever. And so I felt like I was performing for that person and his wife, or for this group of people that I knew. If I was, going to walk up to their table, I would do something. But again, because of that familiarity, I guess, because they know me, they have accepted me, and so they're going to like my magic also. But it wasn't until there was one time I had a show. I remember I was working at the Hilton Hotels in Midland, Texas, and it was on a Saturday night, and I was talking with this fella and his wife. Earlier in the evening during dinner, and then afterwards when I did my after dinner show, packed up the birds and everything, and then the next day I saw this fella in Sunday school class, and that I said, so how'd you like the show? And he said, oh, I'm sorry, I said, the babysitter called, we had to go home early, we missed the show completely, you know. And so I felt like I did a very good show because I was doing it for him, but that was the first time that I realized, there was a whole audience there, none of whom knew me, but they liked the show. They liked me. And so from then on, I felt comfortable doing it for strangers, I guess. You know what I'm saying? It was kind of a strange moment.
I do. I often ask magicians, and this is a lovely trick to help people lose their stage fright. Mm-hmm. I say, why are you going on stage? Well, I'm going to entertain the people, whatever, magic. I said, no. What gets you on stage? Maybe that's a better question. Mm-hmm. What gets you on stage? How do you bridge that one moment where you walk on before you've done anything? you know, you may be revealed in a spotlight or something, but we're talking about walking on stage, that kind of entrance, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I create a moment for myself, and the moment doesn't need to stay. All it is it gets me on stage. My I use something I know, something that touches me or is a memory of mine. My uncle showed me magic when I was 4 and 5 years old, and he passed away when I was 5, actually. But he left me stuff, and he actually kind of got me started, you know, mm-hmm. the interest. And I imagine in my mind that he's sitting out in the middle of the audience in the first row.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, okay, Uncle Amy, you haven't seen me do magic since I was 5 years old, and I'm going to fool the pants off of you. I am just going to make you so proud, and it makes me giggle. And so I go out there kind of looking at the center.
Mm-hmm.
I finish on the center, and I pretend that he's out there.
You play to that imaginary person.
That's right, just mm-hmm. like...
we're talking about Margaret Steele, right.
Margaret Steele,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of that thing. And it sets a tone for me. It mm-hmm. relaxes me. And once I get out there, and if I'm talking or if I'm just, whatever, doing something silent, it just sets the tone. Or maybe there's a very pretty girl out there,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so maybe I want to flirt a little bit. In my mind, I say, I want to date with her,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I go out and I look center and I look right at her and I wink.
Mm-hmm.
and that makes me smile. And maybe I'll say something. We're going to have a great time tonight. And I look at her again and I smile at her.
Yeah.
And it makes me, the audience doesn't know what I'm doing.
Sure.
Really, you know, but it sets the tone for me, and it makes me laugh at myself and I'm relaxed.
Yeah. That's certainly one way of doing it. I think also it's important to have those butterflies before you go out, because it makes you have a heightened sense of awareness and also a freshness that it gives you. Without that, you're just mailing it in, and the audience can sense that also. I've heard Johnny Carson say or talk some years ago about how that every night that he would go out for the Tonight Show, before they would open the curtains, he would just have those butterflies. But it wasn't until they started the applause and he'd say a joke, and then he's off and running. And I often feel the same way before my shows, and just kind of looking out in the curtain, kind of, I think, was it Blackstone or Thurston, I think, it used to say, I love you," just kind
yes.
of, you know, to himself, but towards the audience before that it opens, so that way that he knew that he was going to do a good show. But after I get the first laugh or whatever, it's the same thing. I'm engaged with the audience, and I know, okay, well, this is going to be fun.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. There's another thing I just thought, since you're talking about speech and mm-hmm. actions, and a lot of people speak too fast.
That's my problem.
Well, it's okay. It's okay to speak fast, but what happens is the sentences become run-on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you're not giving the audience anything to do. There's you. What is a show? Who is a show? Are you the show? No. You and the audience are a show. If you're just by yourself, you're rehearsing. But the audience is there. So my question is, what are you giving them to do? They watch a reality show and they see a guy make a choice, and they say, what an idiot. I never would have done that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. Well, this guy is ridiculous. Or he makes a brilliant choice and they say, wow, I never would have thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
This guy is really smart, you know. So they're giving themselves feelings. They're judging somebody with themselves. They're identifying with the person. They're making some judgments. They're involved in a process. So how do we, as magicians, as speakers, how do we involve them in the process? If I said, to use my three sentences before, we're going to start out having breakfast this morning. That's going to really be great. And then we're going to have this lecture. And then after that, we're going to see a show. I gave you no space there to involve you. I ran one sentence, one thought into another.
Mm-hmm.
What? Let's pretend we're the audience, and this guy is up on stage talking to us. What am I thinking? First thing we're going to do is have breakfast. Oh, I wonder what we're going to have. Is it going to be bacon and egg cereal? What are they going to do? Something special? And we're going to like it. Oh, God, I hope I do. This is going to be fun, I think. Yeah, and then we're going to hear a lecture. I wonder who's going to lecture. What kind of lecture is this going to be? Is this on magic or etiquette? Or?
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to see a show. Oh, is it a close-up show? I have mm-hmm. been allowed to involve myself in what you're saying. So
because you're pausing between those items.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
I have, but if I realize, if I play audience, if I go through my script and play audience, now a singer will mark his music. A little check mark above the music score, right?
Mm-hmm.
I love you, check mark. And I take a breath. Check mark. Take a breath. I love you. And so forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he phrases. So we have to learn how to use our scripts in a phrase-like way. Today we're going to have breakfast. And I see them looking, leaning forward and kind of smiling. And I smile back. Oh, it's going to be fun, I tell you. And that allows me, because I'm relaxed, to smile, and they smile. Ooh, he's going to tell us something great. And then, you know, after breakfast, we're going to have a lecture. And, oh, I wonder who that's going to be. Mm, right. And then, right, you know, just like you said, leave a space.
Mm-hmm.
And be involved in what they're thinking. Think what they're thinking, and then go on to the next thing. See how that works. Just try it with one trick. Try it with one effect where you have to speak, you know, and see if that doesn't change things. The trend of my thinking this year, like I said, I kind of found out that if you give a person one thing. Well, I'd never really thought of that. You hear people lecture saying, if you get one thing out of this lecture, then it'll be worth the price. It's kind of the same thing. If I give you one thought, one idea you can use, then it's been worth the price of the workshop.
Sure.
But I didn't get that really until the beginning of this year. After all these years and all this time, I was at the castle early in February, and Glenn Farrington was performing in the close-up room. Well, he looked familiar, and his name sounded familiar, but I didn't remember if I'd seen him before or what.
Mm-hmm.
He did a very nice show, and we connected after the show, and he said, "You don't remember me, do you?" I said, "Well, yes and no. You're familiar, but I don't know why. I can't remember." He said, "Well, okay." He said, "You were in Washington, D.C., doing a pre-Broadway show, and I was one of the kids in Al's magic shop down in the basement. I was 15 years old. We were learning magic. And you came into the shop to say hello to Al, and he brought you downstairs, and you talked to us kids for 45 minutes, I think he said. He said, and you changed my life."
Wow.
I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, you changed my life." I said, "What did I do that changed your life?" He said, "You told me that when I talk to somebody, I should face them."
Hmm.
And I said, "That's it?" He said, "Yeah, isn't that great?" And I said, "Well, yeah, if you say so."
Okay, yeah. For so you it was.
I went home and I said, "Now, how come that was great?" And I said, "Okay, let me create a backstory here. He's 15 years old. So many kids are very shy when they're doing magic, and it's an outlet for them to be appreciated, to get oohs and ahs, to get applause, whatever, makes them feel good. So here's a kid who's kind of sitting sideways to somebody he's doing magic for, or standing sideways, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he's looking at his hands mostly. He's not really performing for anybody. He's kind of hiding by looking at his hands. And maybe he looks up to his right at you, standing there, a little bit, and then looks down at his hands. Now somebody tells him, "No, no, no, you have to face that person. So I turn around in my chair or standing, and I have to face you now. And I look up from my hands a little bit, and it's a little more engaging. It feels different. And I suddenly realize I'm getting a better reaction. So maybe that gives me the courage to really look at the guy, maybe to hold my hands out to show him and not look down so much.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm getting a totally different reaction, and suddenly this takes off, and I became a little more outgoing, and maybe I'm beginning to be a little funnier or something, and it kind of changes my life. It allows me to grow with my age and be more expressive. And I begin to find out who I am and what my strengths are. And that all started with one little idea, because I was told I should face that person when I talk to them. And I go, oh boy.
Wow.
So there it is, because I was challenged. I have a friend who was an actor and was also a magician. And he said, I went to acting school for 4 years. And he said, you tell me in 7 days that you're going to teach these guys what I learned, what it took me 4 years to learn in college about acting. You're going to teach that in a week. And he really put it to me, you know, the left hook business.
Yeah.
I went, no, no, Bill. I can't possibly do that. That's 4 years you spent. I only have 7 days to work with, well, maybe 8 people.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I can't do that. But what I can do, what I hope to do, is to give them at least one thing that they can all use. And I believe they'll get more because they're watching each other and everybody has something else that they need. Something else.
Yeah.
And they may realize that, oh, I can use that. Oh, that's a great idea. I can use that. Besides their one thing. So perhaps they'll learn 4 or 5 things, hopefully.
That's great. You know?
And then they take it, they use it, and they begin to realize that they have strengths that they've never used.
And might be able to apply that to other parts of their lives then as well.
Well, that's a natural.
Sure.
That's inevitable.
Well, as we start to kind of wrap up over here, let me ask for those people who might be interested in taking a workshop or signing up. Do you do these on a regular basis, or how do they find out about them, or how would they go about signing up?
Well, I was doing it on a regular basis, but now, as a matter of fact, I'm up here in above Montreal. That's where we used to hold the workshops. And we've just built a new building, which is a performance building, and it's also a space upstairs to house people. And we really want to start some workshops up here because it's a great performance space.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all inclusive. We'll cater the food in, and they can stay here. And when we did it before, we had little apartments that there were double occupancy. And they had French food every day, and they would stay up late at night and show each other magic as a result.
Yeah.
But then they'd have to get up and come in for 8 o'clock in the morning for yoga. And they used to say, oh my God, yoga at 8 o'clock in the morning. What good is that? And then 11 o'clock at night, when we finished, they'd say, gee, I still feel good. I feel really good.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, how come I still have so much energy and I don't want to go to sleep? I said, because you did yoga this morning. It energized your whole body.
Mm-hmm.
You did a lot of breathing. And anyway, we hope to have more workshops here. In the meantime, I have a workshop in November I'm doing in Delaware. Mark Phillips organized it,
mm-hmm.
and I'm doing that. It's all filled up already. But I always tell people that if they want a workshop in their area, to beat the bushes, find the guys who want to attend.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to do 7-day workshops, and the workshop in Delaware is going to be 4 days, because sometimes it's tough for people to do 7 days.
Mm-hmm.
In four days, something really nice happens. Sometimes people want 2 days, but that's not really enough.
Right.
3 days, 4 days is great. 4 days is great. And maybe I can take 6 people for 4 days. As it is in Delaware, I've got 9 people. So I'll be working with everybody on their acts because everybody gets 2 1.5-hour sessions, which they can videotape if they want. Mm-hmm. And then I like to do workshop stuff, you know, speech and a little yoga,
right.
Movement, blocking, entrances, exits, character work, all that kind of stuff. That's what the workshop is all about. We don't talk about it. You get up and do it, you know, and then you break through your own barriers and you have things that you can therefore take with you, you know. And then we apply it to when you do your piece, the piece that you're working on, to apply these ideas to the piece. And we have 2 sessions like that, 2 1.5-hour sessions. And everybody watches everybody because they learn from everybody, you know.
Right.
And we critique it. And what I tell them is beat the bushes, find the guys, find the place where we can do it. From 11 in the morning until 8 in the morning, I'm sorry, until 11 o'clock at night. And then find a place for me to stay. I can stay at somebody's house. I don't care. And I'll give you a fee for that, and you can split that up amongst the guys. And perhaps I can give it to you half off or even all off for doing all the work,
yeah,
setting it up, organizing, and that whole thing. So
how do they contact you to set that up? I guess they call you because I hear somebody calling in right now, it sounds like.
Yeah, I'm not answering it.
That's okay.
If somebody wants
to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
They can email me at Fitch, F-I-T-C-H, Magic, M-A-G-I-C, Fitch Magic, at AOL.com. Or they can call me. I'll give you my phone if you like.
Okay.
201-947-8014.
There you go.
201-947-8014. And I have a website, FitchMagic.com.
Easy enough
so
to find.
So you can get ideas and stuff, you know, stuff I've written about the process.
Right.
Know.
Well, just again, the last thing here to wrap up, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. And so you've been kind of like Curly from City Slickers saying there's just this one thing. And so what would be that one thing that would be your magic word? Not necessarily the word. It could be a phrase, something that is important to you, that you you live by, your philosophy of life. It could be, again, more than a word. What would be your magic word?
That's hard to pick.
Yeah.
I always say that what we do when we try to do the best that's in us, that it's really a spiritual endeavor. Mm-hmm. I tell magicians, because when they're breaking through all of these things, definitions of themselves and finding new things they never did before, I always tell them that there's no such thing as failure. It's only discovery.
Hmm. That's
no
great.
No such thing as failure. Just
discovery. Well, great. Bob, thank you very much. I appreciate all the good advice and stories that you've told here today. And this is a lot of food for thought. And I appreciate the things you have done for the magic community in general and continue to do by teaching people that one thing that's going to change their lives. So, again.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it.
You're
this
welcome.
This has been a lot of fun, and I hope it helps some people.
Yeah.
Dare to try.
Dare to try. There you go. Thanks very much again.
Thank you.
So, for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Bob Fitch. And until next time, this is Scotty out. I want to again thank my guest, Bob Fitch, for talking with us today and sharing a lot of these great ideas. I hope that you get something out of it as well and are able to improve your performances, as I hope that I can as well. So, until next time, stay well, get booked, and focus on your one thing. This is Scotty out.